Thank you for writing lovely messages. Welcome for our evening, if this indeed is an evening, depending on where you are. This is a gentle vernal spring evening here in the Rhineland. I am delighted to speak in brief about a topic that is dear to me and would just love to welcome you in, whatever your state of mind is, whatever is happening in your life, to stop for a moment to do a few practices of contemplative nature with me for the next half hour and settle the mind. We are all deeply engaged in our stuff, in our lives, and we have many things going on. We have, if your heart is like my heart, then it reaches out to the needs of the moment, the people I care, the causes I cherish, and, you know, the pressures that are in all of our lives. And obviously, we're conscious that many of us practitioners sense the need for spiritual and contemplative practice in a time that is distraught. We have a war running again in Europe, a war many of us thought unthinkable. Many of us grapple to come to terms with in some way, with variety of responses in our hearts, and we need the strength and the vessel for the heart to land, to be able to hold what usually holds our heart in its grip. We need to reverse the procedure and widen, open our arms and be willing to hold what we usually feel in the grip of. So I would like to invite you, wherever you are, to take an upright posture. If you're on a chair, make sure that your feet are flat on the ground, that you remove your back from the backrest, and that you can sit from your pelvis, if that is health-wise possible, and that you can address or redress your posture in such a way that you are upright, that you are in, can find balance, equilibrium, both the mixture of tone to keep you upright and at the same time relaxation to do this uprightness in the greatest possible economy. So let's acknowledge, what can I actually know when I turn away from the invitations to think about the past or to envisage the future? When I turn away from reflection, from fantasizing, from conceiving, when I simply acknowledge what is happening and what I can be cognizant of right now at this immediate moment. Giving up the past, giving up the future, offering the full presence of my mind to this particular moment, however humble it may seem, however unspectacular it may feel, dedicating the plenitude of my mind's capacity to this felt, sensed immediacy, an embodied, heartful moment. It boils down to very simple questions. What is happening now in this body? How does this feel right now? Can I be in a conscious, non-reactive relationship to this experience? What is happening now in this body? How does this feel? And can I be in a non-reactive, conscious relationship to the quality of my experience right now? If you're familiar with stillness exercises, this is the moment where you recall that we can wake up, where you recall that you are intelligent, discerning for the principles that govern our experience, where you recall that you're not alone, that there are friends on the path, beings that share our aspirations. We have examples. We have practitioners whose footsteps we can trace, we can follow. We have wisdom teachings. We are more privileged than any other generation in the wake of the Buddha's path. Save maybe the direct disciples of the Buddha, probably no other time has had so much access to wisdom teachings as ours. As crazy as our time seems to feel, as blessed are we to be in this particular time. So acknowledge your posture and the felt sense of your posture. Acknowledge your weight, the touch sensations, the movement of your breathing, and let us receive the immediacy and the reality of this experience into our consciousness. Just me receiving this moment as it feels, as it is sensed, as an embodied reality, as I can find myself in the midst of this life, breathing sensate. Exquisitely sensitive. Gently presencing the mind, disentangling my attentional focus from thoughts, plans, reminiscences, and turning the attentional focus to the receiving. Think of yourself as a host at the doorway, guests arriving, and you're welcoming these guests. You compliment them in. You look at them, smile at them, address them with a few words. Make them feel at ease. Let them know they are seen. The same way, let us receive the breath and its sensations as it reaches and touches and nourishes the body. Receive the breath into the consciousness. Let us acknowledge orientation in this body. There are contact surfaces this body touches that touch this body as much as this body touches them. This body makes contact with its environment, a cushion, a chair, palms that may rest in your lap, on your thighs. There is a world around me that is felt in a myriad of ways. My skin is capable of a wide variety of sensory functions, warmth, movement, pressure, humidity, many, many more, over 20 different sensory skin functions. This body is capable of feeling itself from the inside, not just via the skin. Differing degrees of density. Solidity. Resistance. Again, a myriad of inner sensations. When I turn to these sensations, landscapes open, soft ones, solid ones, compact ones, ones with a lot of discrete, varied little felt impulses, others strangely white patches on my inner map. Some reassuring solidity, some warmth, some softness. So take a moment to acknowledge the diversity of your inner world. Bodies are beautifully intelligent. And take a moment to ponder where does the inside end and the outside of your experience begin? If you are sensing, touching, palpating this world, with your senses, as one of our philosophers has it, where does the inside of my world end and where does the outside of my world begin? Ponder whether this makes sense as a question. Is really my skin the boundary? Do I not feel the world outside with my sensorium inside? Or are there distinct thresholds, boundaries, limits? I'd like you to feel this question rather than to ask it in your head. I'd like you questioning your body gently. Dear body, where does the inside end and where does the outside begin if I sit here? Gently breathing, gently listening, gently befriending whatever turns up. Take a moment to acknowledge what you find your attention to be preoccupied with right now. If you find your attention is straying, is moving in the past and the future, gently bring the attentional focus back, and if it is last minute, see whether it is possible to attend in an undivided way, just the sequence of sensations in your breathing, the coming and the going, the rising and falling, the widening, the relaxation. Good, please stretch and return your attention outside. Take a moment to readjust your posture. I kindly would like to indulge your attention for a topic that is dear to my heart. It is a topic that goes by many names. I have called it touching the earth and turning the mind to its roots. It is a teaching that is found in innumerable places in early Buddhist texts and the discourses in Pali and the Sanskrit tradition. And in some strange way, this particular teaching is not, I think, as famous as it ought to be. I personally would understand that it is probably one of the great contributions in the history of mind, and particularly the history of contemplative life, one of the great contributions of early Buddhist teaching to make so much of this particular teaching. We find that at the basis of the entire system of Buddhist mind training, there is a particular orientation towards experience that goes by many names. It is a form of investigation, of applying the attentional powers and the attentional faculty of the mind that is particularly transformative. This teaching in tonight, I think, is encapsulated in the topic of what is called yoniso manasikara in the language of Pali. But actually, it has many, many synonyms. It has this examination, orientation, investigation is a huge theme and recurs in many places under many different terms in early Buddhist teaching. All of these terms have something to do with slowly, carefully, questioningly holding something longer and more patiently than we would. the term yonisomanasikara is maybe the most clear and in many ways encapsulates that attitude. Think of that skill. Think of yonisomanasikara not as a method. Think of it as an attitude. Let me say something about the word itself, because the word itself is quite interesting. Yoni, as many of you will know, is the womb, technically the uterus, and in a metaphorical sense, it is the place of origin. It is where things begin. It is the matrix, if you so want. Yeah, we have it in the Latin word also. In a similar sense, it is the root where things begin. Yeah. So yoniso is an ablative understanding or beginning where things, from where things begin, would be the literal translation from yoniso. And manasikara is usually translated as attention. It is the applying of the mind. Manas, or karoti, making the mind do something. So we have, when we have this strange Pali term, and I'm not sure how enthusiastic you are for etymologies or Pali terms, but I would like to indulge your patience for tonight, because I think that holds really some potency. That term speaks of applying one's attentional faculty in a way that understands things from the root. One slightly snappy way of relating this could be calling this radical attention in the sense, in the original sense of the word, radical, yeah, from the root. Or, so it is an attitude of mind that understands things from the root into the ramification of, say, the branches and the twigs. Think of a gesture when you take hold of a plant that you would like to repot. And you're not just pulling up the plant, you're not just cutting close to the plant, you're actually taking earth with the plant. Yeah, a sort of surrounding, encompassing gesture. And then you're lifting this plant gently out of its receptacle so that you do not injure the fine little roots that look to sustain the plant. So it is a kind of a gentle turning attitude. It is a holding. It is a caring attitude. And it is very thorough. There's something very, very thorough. And so Western folks have translated that term in many, many different way, in many different ways. Let me give you a few examples. Wise attention, careful attention, appropriate attention, thorough attention, methodical attention, skillful attention, proper consideration. Then some more exotic terms that in some strange way, as weird as they may sound, actually showcase a particular aspect of that fascinating quality. One of them, a very old translator, called it tracing back things to their origin. Or appropriate contemplation, or in investigative depth, skillful reflection. One very exotic guy called it studious etiological examination, which is unlikely to really make the charts, but he actually has a point. Yeah, the understanding of the conditional nature of an event and how it arises, that it arises and how it arises, is actually not bad. It does actually point out a key piece. So I like a particular term. It comes from the naval, old naval craft, I like the term fathoming. Yeah. If you remember, some of you may recall this, a fathom is a weight you have with a thread. And this was used with somebody standing in the bow of the ship in water that was shallow. So to make sure to find out how much water you have under your keel, somebody would stand in the bow of the ship and throw out the fathom, yeah, the weight with the thread, and then feel when it would hit the ground so that he knew how much water there was, how safe the boat still was. So going to the ground of something, yeah, taking the fathom and touching the ground beneath something. Yeah, I think that's a very good, that's a very fine example. As you can see with many of these terms, it's awkward if you treat them as technical terms. They basically, they become flat and slightly square. Yeah, you become from the image that speaks of an attitude of great care and touching things from their roots and following how they develop to careful attention or wise attention, there's a considerable loss in flavor and in the illustrative nature of things. So enough of etymology. Why is yoniso manasikara, wise attention or appropriate attention, why is it so important? Let me read you a very small passage that the Buddha gave in two places. He says, mendicants, it is by wise attention, by yoniso manasikara, by wise striving, yoniso sammapadana, I have arrived at the unsurpassed liberation. I have realized the unsurpassed liberation. You too, mendicants, you too, practitioners, by wise attention, by wise striving, shall arrive at such unsurpassed liberation, shall realize such unsurpassed realization. This is what he says shortly after his awakening. And this comes to some surprise, I would expect, because you would expect him to say something like, I have come to my realization and through countless ethical acts of perfecting my perfections, I come to my liberation through profound meditative experiences. I come to my breakthrough, my existential breakthrough, by dint of my powerful wisdom. Yeah, you would expect that he somehow refers to some of his more famous qualities, yeah? Wisdom, samadhi, ethics, the ardor that he has put into perfecting his virtues, all the stuff Buddhists generally are harping on about. Yeah? But here, very shortly after his awakening, he says, look, I have come through my liberation through yoniso manasikara. I have come through liberation by holding things carefully, by tracing things back to their origin, by turning attention to the root of things. Yeah. We have many places in the Buddhist teaching where yoniso manasikara is praised. It is seen as one of the two sources for appropriate understanding. Yeah. A key piece, appropriate understanding, samma ditti in the Eightfold Path, has two big sources. One of them is what we can learn from others. Paratogosa, what we can pick up from others. In the days of the Buddha, when there were no writing, no written records, when there were no YouTube talks, when there were no MP3s, when there were no books, the only way you could learn something was to associate with somebody who you were convinced has something to teach or to speak or to say. In other words, learning. This was always understood in Buddhist traditions, is a relational activity. Learning takes place within the context of a relationship. Yeah? That is unquestionable. You don't just figure things out for yourself. Yeah? Most people will need other people to help them. Even the Buddha, who in some ways did not have awakened teachers, needed teachers. Yeah? He needed inspiration. He needed help. He needed reflection, challenge. He needed companionship. And so it is no wonder that one source of obtaining appropriate understanding is gaining that by associating with others. For our time, this would mean we learn what we can learn from others. We have more possibilities today. Yeah? We have written material. We have records of a living tradition. We have records of historical traditions. We have a wealth and an abundance of knowledge that is available. And in fact, it is one of the huge privileges of our time that Buddhist traditions that not necessarily talked with each other for centuries, that these traditions land in our countries. Wherever you are, you will have access to some of these teachings. You will have access to various Buddhist traditions in generally a breadth and diversity that for most of the people who are your teachers or your teachers' teachers will not have been existing. Yeah. This is really something new, that these teachings and these traditions meet on Western ground, that they meet on Eastern ground, that they start acknowledging each other and meeting each other. You know, some of these guys have been behind the mountains, others on their islands, and they had maybe some books about each other, but they didn't necessarily talk with each other. So this is a huge privilege. For us, paratagosa, the words of others, can come in many more ways than they came in the days of the Buddha. Still, I would probably stand by this, that we learn within relationship. As we learn about ourselves generally in relationship, and this is not just the ex-monk and the therapist speaking here, I trust you will be with me on this, that many of the things that are crucial pieces of your learning will take place within some form of relationship. Now, the other source of obtaining appropriate understanding, of obtaining sammaditti, is yoniso manasikara. It is turning to our own experience in appropriate ways, attending to our own experience in ways that turn this experience, however pleasant or however painful, that turn this experience into the soil of our insights, into the soil of that which helps our heart to grow, to develop, to flourish. So yoniso manasikara has been understood to have basically two huge tasks. Yeah? And you will find these huge tasks very elegantly summed up in the early Indic tradition. I think the first time I have found him is with a teacher called Asanga, who basically boiled down the problem of human ignorance to two different sets, to two different areas. One area is what he called Jnaya Varana. It is the obstruction or the obscuration with respect to things that I have not understood or that I have misunderstood. Yeah. That's very elegant. You know, all the stuff that I labor with misunderstandings, all the stuff that I simply don't know, or even worse, the things that I believe I do know, but that they are just not as I think they are. You know? So my empirical mistakes, for example. So this is one of the problems of our big contemplative task. And the other task is it's the obscurations, the avaranas, that are basically bad habits, yeah, that come from, that afflict the heart as kilesas, as kleshas, as obscurations. And these kleshas, they can be anxiety, fear, anger, desire, depression. You know, there's many different ways we would, in psychological language, refer to these afflictions. Destructive emotions, neurosis, hang-ups. Basically, they are bad habits of the mind and the heart. So we have two problems. One is a lack of understanding, and the other is bad habits of the mind and the heart that stop us from engaging in ways that allow us to develop. Yoniso Manasikara can help us in both of these departments. Yeah. Yoniso Manasikara, wise reflection, can aim directly at cutting off or eliminating ignorance, the forms of unknowing. There are many different forms of not knowing things, from simply not having information about it, to resisting things we already know but don't want to know, to being flooded with detailed data and information that we cannot put together and enact in some organic way, to stuff that we know, but we somehow find it doesn't transform the heart yet. Yeah, we know about it. We are, but somehow we can only visit. We can't actually live there. Yeah, we keep failing in areas that we find that our knowledge has validity, plausibility, but somehow it hasn't transformed the heart. Yeah, so that's one area where Yoniso Manasikara is understood by the tradition. Many teachings and texts about this to help grow the capacity of the human heart to understand more deeply in a way that the heart actually lets go, yeah, that we find release. The other side is that Yoniso Manasikara is aiming to reduce and finally to give up craving and grasping and the habits of the heart, of the habits of the clinging heart, the inflations of the clinging heart, the incontinence of the clinging heart, the desperate attempts to be happy with stuff that doesn't really deliver a happiness that we long for. You know, some happiness is there, but it may not be the happiness that leaves us content or sated or complete or genuinely partaking in the fullness of our lives. So Yoniso Manasikara is set to both directly help cut off and eliminate not forms of not knowing, forms of delusion, forms of confusion, forms of ignorance. And Yoniso Manasikara is also said to help with reducing the patterning, the patterns of craving, patterns of grasping, the bad habits, you know, the repetition and the amplification of stuff we know is not going to make us happy, not going to make us content, not going to leave us with self-respect. So these are interesting things. The tradition says a number of interesting things. So one aspect of Yoniso Manasikara is figuring out how to develop skills to grow. Figuring out skill in means. So there is one type of Yoniso Manasikara which is good at finding the knack of something. Yeah? It's not genuine big wisdom, but it's finding the knack of something. So the knack of how does something happen that I don't want to happen? If I can't stop it, can I investigate what it takes for this thing to happen? Can I acknowledge that it arises? Okay, I'm not denying anymore. That's already step one. That's good. Can I acknowledge when it arises? It's not there all the time. So sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. That means it's fluctuating. And when it's fluctuating, it will have causes and conditions that bring it about. Can I investigate which are the causes and the conditions? Can I investigate how it arises? Yeah. And as soon as we go down that route, we begin to understand and familiarize ourselves with the problem. We begin to understand ourselves, to familiarize ourselves with our reactivity to the problem. And it turns out that Yoniso Manasikara is a godsend when it comes to slowing down, when it comes to making the mind more capable of understanding, making the mind less reactive. This attitude of holding things by understanding them from their root is a suitable and methodical approach. The second one of these aspects is finding the right approach. So finding skills and means, practical knacks, and then finding the right approach to something. There are many possible approaches, but there is one that is particularly effective. Yeah. One aspect of Yoniso Manasikara has to do with reasoned and orderly handling of sequence. So what is primary? What is secondary? What is conditional? What is resultant? Getting clarity around this. And finally, one aspect of Manasikara has to do with effectiveness in one's approach. So there is a question there, an orientation question that says, is what am I doing effective in terms of what I wish to do? Obviously, it would be lovely if we had a week's time and I can take you through a number of examples of this. Buddhist teaching easily comes up. You know, you could practice with the four ennobling tasks in terms of Yoniso Manasikara as a reflective framework. You could practice with dependent arising as a reflective investigative framework. You can practice with how to hold the types of grasping and investigate grasping with the reflecting framework of, you know, that it arises, how it arises, that it ceases, how it ceases, what its gain is, what its payoff is, and also what its danger is. Yeah, there are wonderful reflections, all of them under the heading of Yoniso Manasikara. And I would like you to have a look, see whether, wherever you listen to teachings, question your teachers about this teaching. Be on the lookout for textual sources, for applied sources. I have received great inspiration from a contemporary Thai teacher who has a wonderful example of Yoniso Manasikara. And he says, Yoniso Manasikara basically is, it's the link between mindfulness and wisdom. Yeah? Yoniso Manasikara is the bridge between applied mindfulness, you know, the full presence of mind, and the development of wisdom. So he says, think of somebody, and this is a Thai example. So this is a person rowing in a boat out into a choppy river. The idea is to pick flowers or water greens, possibly lotuses, because lotuses can be eaten, not just looked at. And the person goes out, paddles out into to the plants, and then ties the boat or anchors the boat in such a way that the boat is stationary at the spot where the plants grow. Yeah. And then with one hand, this person reaches out over the board of the boat and grasps the stems of these plants, holds, gathers them together, and exposes these plants or the stems of these plants with a particular bend so that they are conveniently exposed to the harvesting arm or the knife, the sickle, the Thai chopping knife, a little machete, or a little scythe that is used for harvesting water plants. So we have a boat. The boat is something like the mind. The anchor that keeps the boat stationary is sati, is mindfulness. Then the arm that bends the stems of the plants and prepares them for the cut. This is yonisomanasikara. And the cutting hand, finally, that harvests the plants, this is wisdom. This is the wisdom that relieves us from our afflictions, the wisdom that is seeing through things, that is capable of making transparent conditionality and releasing the heart. So this is it's not a canonical image, although it uses elements from canonical teachings, and I have always found that quite illustrative, the interplay between mind, mindfulness, yonisomanasikara, the preparatory gesture, and then the workings of wisdom that does the major work of liberating the heart. So, yes, I hope some of this is inspiring and possibly makes you curious. I'm conscious we haven't gone to great depth on this in the half hour we have, and I would like to make a little break here and open this up for questions. So if you have the heart, please speak up and show your face. I would enjoy giving you the space and coming forth with a question, and we'll try to respond to that as good as I can, or use the questions box in the bottom of your screen. You should have an ask a question button that allows you to type up a question, and then we'll look whether we can respond to this. Yeah. I'm grateful for your support of Sangha Life, who makes a great offer and has an international Dharma hall here, gathered over various continents. And the good work of Sangha Life has spread into many corners of the globe. And please, if you have it in you and if you have the means, do support both the infrastructure and the good people of Sangha Life. There is more than George. You will have others and great inspiration, people who quietly work behind the scenes and hold things together, as you can imagine. And also, I will be grateful for your support. So let's see whether you have something of a response. I am not sure, George, can everybody read these questions?
Yes, and you have two questions already in the inbox. You can go through them if you want, please.
Yep, thank you. Thank you. Well, Professor Fisher, I think that Buddhism seems to point away from using our intelligence. This is one of the misunderstandings of our time. It has something to do maybe with the background of many of the seekers who came to Buddhist teaching, at least in my sort of Icebeard generation, we were fed up with Western intellectual approaches and realized that there are many things that are not happening, and that intellectual fatigue in some way has maybe translated in some of our perceptions of Buddhism. But if Buddhist teachings are actually allowed to speak for themselves, then you will find that there is a great appreciation of good thinking, not just meditation and the suspicious nature of the reality of thought, but really solid appreciation of clear-headed reason thinking. In most Buddhist traditions I know, there is a lot of that. It's not just meditation and thought as a meditative hindrance. It's there is no doubt in my mind that the Buddha was greatly appreciative of not just the capacity to know things, but also the capacity to reflect on things, to, in an organic way, use the stuff that I have heard and learned in a applied and engaged way. And then on top, obviously, there is the contemplative dimension of stillness practice and insight practices that are deemed to be necessary for genuine liberation. But without proper thinking, there is no good practice without decent theory. Yeah, I think that's very clear. That is as clear for the critical theory of Adorno and Horkheimer, and that is as clear for early Buddhist teaching. And in fact, any Buddhist tradition I have some acquaintance of. Yeah. No. What you write, you know, our attempts, we are not just called to let this world not touch us, you know. If you read my little piece about touching the earth, the Buddha is, as an ascetic warrior, male ascetic warrior maybe, he cannot be overwhelmed anymore by Mara, so the legend goes. But at the same time, he remains besieged by Mara. It is only when he calls upon the feminine and he calls upon the earth that Mara rolls back. His freedom proper sets in. His liberation process cannot be obtained by simply becoming invincible. He has to somehow acknowledge that he belongs, and he has to acknowledge that he is touched and he is witnessed by the earth. And, you know, Buddhists, if you look, have produced a lot of art. They have produced poetry. Any look into particularly South Asian, Southeast Asian traditions will tell you Buddhism has had a major impact on the arts, not just on some of the sciences, but also on some of the arts. We are touched by many things in the world, and I think it'd be just because a particular brand of Buddhism and a particular brand of Buddhist practice that seems to go into meditation halls and frown upon maybe music and movement and the color doesn't mean that this has been the case. Buddhist art is testified for, you know, as long as we have testimonies of Buddhist epigraphy, iconography. You know? India is a living testimony of this. So I'm heartened. Don't be talked out of using your mind, and please do. There is nothing wrong in art and music and poetry. The Buddhist texts themselves speak in more than candid ways about this. Yeah. Thank you for this. Let me go on. How do you spell the word for this topic? Okay. I Oh, good. So you've probably seen the word is spelled Yonisomanasikara. If you want the proper accents, let me just see. I'll put it in as a question. So this would be with the proper Pali accents. Yes, this is question number two with three votes from Isola. I have given some examples in writing, reflections on the four truths. The famous Thai teacher Bhikkhu Paiyutta speaks of 10 different ways of investigating causes and conditions, analyzing component factors, reflecting in terms of the three characteristics, understands the relationship between goals, atta, and principles, dhamma. There could be many others used. Think of slowing down the process of something that you do not understand. Think of widening your perceptual field for something you don't understand. Begin to ponder the phenomenon. So, does it change? Does it belong to me? What is its aspect of suffering? Then, can I identify individual causes? Yeah. Can I identify specific conditions which bring it about? And when these conditions are not there, which make it go away or avoid it taking place? Those would be examples. Yeah. I understand that we would need to tease that out further and to basically exercise this. This will not be possible tonight, but there are a few people who make such courses, who speak about this, and I can only encourage you to question teachers, or you go to Dharma Seed and you Google Yonisomanasikara and you see whether something comes up. Yonisomanasikara is not something you necessarily do during meditation practice. If you think of meditation practice as a formal sitting on the cushion, yeah, Yonisomanasikara does not need the cushion. You understand that goes, obviously you can do that on the cushion, but this is not a cushion only practice. We need to take meditation out of the meditation hall and the sitting on the cushion. You know, this is the Buddha's notion of meditation is called bhavana, and that means a variety of things. Sitting on a cushion is one of the aspects of it, not all of them. So the idea to kind of bring this Yonisomanasikara as a meditation method is too narrow. You know? You have to, obviously, you can ponder on your cushion, but this is not something to replace anapanasati or satipatthana practice or metta practice. Yeah, this is something to be doing outside of your formal meditation practice. While you can do on your cushion and ponder and fathom and sift through things, obviously, there is a conflict of interest if you want to do samatha practice and still the mind. Yeah, Yonisomanasikara is an investigative practice. Mental proliferation is spinning. Yeah, it's speeding up. It's what Buddhist tradition would call Yonisomanasikara, turning the mind away from the roots, spinning out into the periphery. Yeah? So when you notice things get more and more complex and you move away into the periphery, then this is not Yonisomanasikara. Then this is possibly the opposite, or just simple, papancha, yeah, conceptual proliferation. Victoria, please come online.
I have invited Victoria. We're just waiting for her. And until we wait for her, just to let you know that there's an upvoted question with 5 votes just on top. If you scroll up, a small question from Robin, you might want to take it afterwards.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Robin. Well, let me respond to that. How might you apply Yoni Somanasikara to a depressed mood or sadness? Well, there's 2 things there. One of them is an intervention technique, and the other one would be a prophylactic technique. The intervention technique means you need to do something. When you're depressed or sad, you need to act, preferably anything embodied, movement. The greatest known antidepressant to mankind is called motor movement. Get out. I know this is difficult. If you're depressed, you don't have very much motivation. Move. Whatever you do, go for a walk, do push-ups, walk around a block, engage in a motor way with your environment. You have to do something. There is nothing more powerfully brightening the mind than motor movement. The prevalence of our depression has many, many factors. It has to do with meaning. It has to do with, it's obviously the ailment of our time. If you look at the figures in many developed countries. It is also something to do with our sedentary lifestyles. So the intervention technique would be to engage with something, to do something, to stop thinking about yourself. That would be and do something. Whether it makes sense, whether it's pleasant or not, whether it's immediately meaningful or not, whether you find it attractive or not, doesn't matter. Your subjective well-being doesn't really matter at that moment. But when you engage something, the chances are that your depressed mood or your sadness will shift. Also, I think it's good to distinguish depression and sadness. While there are many good reasons to be sad, depression is obviously something that is not helpful, while sadness, particularly grief, will take you to the end of this process. If you engage with this properly, if you allow sadness to be felt, depression does not. Depression does not have self-healing capacities like sadness has. So I would think there may be good reasons for your sadness. And, depression is a malfunction. It's not something that is helpful. So it's skillful to intervene when you sense yourself depressed. While it may not be necessary to intervene with sadness, because the resolution to your sadness may be that you are sad and you allow yourself to feel that way, which works with sadness and it doesn't with depression. The prophylactic part of Yoni Somanasikara with depression is obviously that you figure out under what conditions you are most prone to fall into sadness. Now, Buddhist teaching has some very clear things to say about this. It is likely that thinking about yourself is particularly prone. That's with also mindfulness-based cognitive depression and therapy, and particularly relapse prevention would say there is a lot of research there. One of the most effective way to get a depressive relapse is to just think in unskillful ways, just think a little bit about yourself. You know? One of my teachers used to say, if I want to be depressed, all I do is I think a little bit about myself. Yeah. He used to say. Much cognitive rumination, autobiographic rumination, that's the jargon for the term. Much autobiographic rumination runs the risk of depressive relapses or depressive patterning. Yeah. I hope that's a start. Let me go back and see whether Victoria.
Well, I can.
Have we lost her?
Yeah, no, she's unable to connect, and I've tried to see all the steps, and there's something wrong. But she's okay, not coming on screen because she wants you to keep on answering the questions. I will try to see if I can bring her on, but please keep on. Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm reading Erica. Hi. Right. Definitely not ontological statement. The Buddha is very careful with ontological statements, in my understanding. He has, on the background of rather ontologically enthusiastic traditions like the Vedic and the Upanishadic traditions, he has shifted his perspective away from the what something is, this would be the ontological question, to the how something works. This would be more the phenomenological point of view. Many of his strategies are heuristic. I would agree with you. I can only recommend turning to Bhikkhu Paiuto. He is probably one of the most competent voices on the topic. If you listen to me, you will hear much of his inspiration. In the stuff I say, I have studied with him and I have been greatly and continue to be greatly inspired with his output and his understanding. He has pointed many, many key teachings that somehow have failed to be listed and ontologized in the sort of classic Theravada taxonomies. I have greatly benefited from his studious and repeated output on these topics. Yeah. I think the spelling we have clarified. George.
Excuse me to interrupt you. But we have an upvoted question with 8 votes on the top from Gregory Kramer.
Thank you. Hi, Gregory. Let me just read what you write. Gregory, you're perfectly right. The voice of another is not necessarily a teacher. Yeah, that is not the message in the early Pali teachings. Generally, this is a good friend. Yeah, I would say more than the teacher. Actually, the good friend is meant the inspired fellow human being. I do not think that this, you know, presupposes a teacher-disciple relationship. It presupposes a relationship of listening and respect. I understand something that is very much important to you and that you have done a lot of tremendous good work in making this clear and helping people to become hands-on with this. Yeah, I hope this is a response. Yeah, I'm grateful for you to bring this up. The voice of another is not necessarily an accepted authority on a particular topic. It is primarily an available and an aspiring fellow being, a good friend, a Kalyana Mitta, preferably somebody with some experience, preferably somebody who is available. I think that would be the key piece for me. Preferably somebody who has a practice and who is engaging in the values rather than just an authority or a pundit or an instructor. Yeah. Yep. Good. Let me see. I'd like to respond to the comment from Zora. I'm sorry if that was intellectually challenging. The course you refer to, you see, many of these teachings need contextualizing, and that is work. We would like to be picked up with teachings of a wisdom tradition that come from another time and another culture in the terms and tacit understandings that we have, or some of us have in different corners of the world. That wish is understandable, but it's unrealistic. If we engage with big stuff, it is very likely to challenge some of our preconceptions, our notions, and we will very likely have to learn something. Yeah. Every science, every craft has its own language. If you speak with craftsmen of any brand, you will find they have a language, they have references, they have tools, they have models of how to approach and conceptualize the problem they engage with or the tasks they have given themselves. And there is some complexity in this. And I'm afraid this is probably the case with Buddhist teaching. You know, obviously, there are Buddhist teachings that are immediately accessible. They can be illustrated. They're approachable, they immediately make sense. And then there's other aspects which have depth and applicability and profundity to them, but that need to be teased out. You know, some things give juice immediately if you put them in your mouth, and some things you need to prepare, you need to chew, you need to savor before they actually start to give you their juice. And that is work. Yeah, some of that work has to do with philology. Some of it has to do with cultural translation. Some of it has to do with didactics. And I'm glad you're still here. And I take heart that you have not been put off by this topic or this experience and come back. So thank you for your patience. Ah, okay. I should have done that. I should have here. I'm asked to kindly read each of the questions aloud before answering, so we know what you're replying to. We're not all looking at our screens all the time. Thank you. I apologize. I should have done that. I am, to be honest with you, this is my first crowdcast experience, and I'll be smarter the next time. I apologize if you have missed out what question I have responded to. I have tried to mention the names of people that have asked. So let me do that from Bartek. Thank you very much for your interesting talk on meditation. Just practice in meditation of feeling ending inside and beginning outside should point me to the connectedness with everything and no boundaries while closed eyes, or should point me to just one place when it's all happening like mine. But I think it should point you to your own experience. I don't have a preordained opinion I would like you to become aware of whether and where such a boundary is in your own experience. Obviously, we are connected with the world and we depend on this world. We exchange, we have a metabolism, we have a gaseous exchange. We hang all together in this biosphere and we are quite objectively connected with each other, whether we feel that or not. I'm much more interested in enabling and encouraging you to probe into your experience with the spirit of Yoni Somanasikara rather than didactically pushing you to have a particular type of experience. Yeah, that would be my idea. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for your many questions. I've seen the first one at the top. I believe I have not responded to. In touching the ground, the earth, in belonging to this earth, do we allow ourselves to be vulnerable? Yes, Pauline, I think there is no way around that we have to acknowledge our own vulnerability. With that vulnerability, to which I would count the inarguable mortality, I think we become better human beings. You know, how much we can allow ourselves to feel that vulnerability depends on your psychological robustness, your immediate environment. But it's better to know that we are vulnerable. The thought that we are not tends to breed bad habits in human beings. We behave badly if we think we're all invulnerable. Yeah. Yes, I would wish very much that this vulnerability is also combined with a sense of gratitude and the capacity to rejoice. Yeah. There is something amazing in consciousness. There is something amazing in life. Yeah. And no amount of Buddhist harping on suffering and impermanence should blind us that there is genuine amazement going on. This mind is capable of genuine amazement and genuine heartening connectedness. So, I thank you for engaging with me in this way. I hope wherever you are, you will make good use of these teachings. You, if any of this is stimulating or inspiring, please make it yours, metabolize it. If there were off-putting things, you may reflect on what is particularly off-putting and may leave it at that. Maybe there are other valuable teachings and other valuable people who have something to offer to you. And I apologize if I have not done justice to things or muddled things up or not addressed your particular situation or your particular need. Please do not be put off by one single teacher trying to make sense of an awe-inspiring and powerful teaching. There may be other voices that can help you more. Yeah. I thank you for your attention and your heart. And George, do we need to convey anything more? Or can we end with a moment of silence?
Yes, we've gone past the time, but we can end with a moment of silence. And I thank you very much for your time and your wisdom and your patience and your first time. And I hope you will come back many times. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Let's just one little minute. Let's drop into beingness for a moment and widen our heart. Whatever good comes from our practice, may this be shared by all sentient beings. May all beings be free. May all beings be safe. May all beings be well. May they never be separated from the goodness they have obtained. I thank you for your presence. May you be well. And thank you, George.